talk about why land is so valuable, because I think it's, of course, why it's more valuable than any other asset class, because everything else is, I told Danny, once we get to a certain point, when people understand like we have a more better personality, I'm gonna say if you're doing like houses and apartments and all that, we're gonna refer to them as junk collectors. Shots fired.
Don't start a war now.
Yeah, no, don't do that shit.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, but I was joking because like in my mind, it's all like it's depreciating. It's depreciating.
You're gonna start acting like Tucker Carlson right now. No, start fucking.
I'm kidding, but think the way that my mind just goes there. Like if you're buying houses or apartment complexes or self storages. It's always plumbing, falling apart. Something's, plumbing, you know,
electrical,
and people AC. Are like, oh no, self storages, they're built the best, they need no maintenance, cool, whatever, they're depreciating assets, right? So, and then it's also finite. So if you buy like 100,000 square feet, you're like a big winner, right? But 100,000 square feet of land is a very small deal.
Yeah.
Right? So it just, you know, there's so much more upside out there. If you think about it, right? There's a fixed amount of rooftops for apartments and self storage in any major metroplex. But then just hit the land and just go in any direction, and it's infinite. It's like 100,000 square foot building next to another one, to another one, to another one, all the way into infinity in all directions. So just the amount that's out there.
Yeah, and this, I think we were talking about this earlier. I think it was with you earlier about how land is an underserved community, that it's hard for get financing, it's hard to find it, it's hard to piece it together, it's hard to understand it, it's hard to comp it. There's so many like facets of the land game that it makes it hard to acquire. And you're talking about the banks underwriting it. They can't understand how to underwrite it because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, they don't have enough data. They don't have enough data. And the thing is, I think the industry in of itself doesn't have the right push for that data to come up. And not only that, but because lenders as a whole don't want to participate to the same capacity as residential and commercial, then investors themselves, they don't want to be part of it either.
Yeah.
So land becomes a commodity that only very few, like yourselves, can tap into it, knowing how to properly do it. Yeah. And that not anybody can tap into it. So it's a very interesting game, and we're here to play.
Nah, the Mina and his talk about this all the time, with it being the biggest blue ocean out there in real estate in general, because
it's a big ocean.
There's it's so many like different variables of value add. Years ago, I think when I sent you a video about how Phoenix expanded into the desert, essentially, because Phoenix is a desert, how it was just nothing, barren land, and now it's Scottsdale, you know? And there's ever-improving involvement of that land as it increases and population grows and skyscrapers.
I saw that time-lapse, how like they make the 10-acre tracks and they get smaller and smaller.
They get smaller and smaller, and then you get density. And even here in Houston, we're going to record another video about how even then it transitions over time. The land transitions from regular housing, 100-year-old housing because it's an older city, to now you got three-level condo houses, which we'll cover that in a second. But the transgression of time, it elapses and creates anything over time and distance. As long as the people are there, the jobs are there, and people have an imagination to create whatever, and the counties allow it to build whatever you want, whatever makes sense, that's when growth happens. And I think the land investors are the phase one of growth.
Yeah.
Literally. And the owners, they're, I think, the pre-stage, because they've been holding it for 50 years, waiting for somebody like us to come build and create the opportunity for everybody else. So there's like the different stages of growth and involvement in any given city, and it happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And it all starts with land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so interesting how, the way that you put it is, you know, you start with, you know, somebody that inherited property.
Yep.
To some degree. Most of it comes from that.
Yep.
Right? They're, you know, settlers from back in the 1800s. And even beyond that point, you know, you have a piece of land, 100 acres, 1,000 acres plus, and there's nothing except grass and trees.
Nothing.
And then you fast forward to the last descendant of, you know, that family that now has a smaller piece of that, and come to a point where like, so now what do I do with this? You know, they're 60, 70, 80 years old, about to, into retirement age. What now? Well, guess what? people like us step into the plate and we take over from there and repurpose that beautiful piece of property to make it a landscape for any creator to kind of put their thoughts together, their sort of resources together, and build something beautiful out of it.
Can you cover that story? Because I think you mentioned it off camera, but the story of the street being named in Austin, and that's the last living heir of that street owner name.
Yeah.
Can you kind of cover that?
Yeah,
an interesting story.
What street was it?
So it's called D. Gabriel Collins Road. And the story, and I may be a little off with this, but the story is that D. Gabriel Collins was a African-American investor, land investor, that acquired hundreds of acres around that area back in the early 1900s.
Amazing.
And what happened, so he acquired that with, I think, his brother at the time. And the brother decided to liquidate some of his real estate, but D. Gabriel decided to keep a lot of his. And throughout history, he decided to part ways with some of it with his family. Well, family, some of them, or most of it, they decided to sell it, cash out, and do something else. Mm-hmm. And there's very few that are remaining. And the ones that we have right now under contract, I think it's the last. There's actually one more besides that one, but we got the two out of the last three.
Remainder lots on that street.
On that street from the last lineage of that person throughout the past 100 plus years.
That's amazing.
That's so cool, dude. What a cool story. What a great piece of property, too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how that kind of unfolds. I mean, you just never know the history behind land. It's just so cool because there's so much depth behind it. And it's not just the transaction part of things, but it's the connections that you get with sellers and the story behind that. You know, it's I love the storytelling behind why and how it became. You know?
So I have an interesting story too. So when I lived in Georgia, I lived on like a one-way dead end street. It was a long strip property that they just cut off, and the developer came in and put a road down the middle and cut off slices down the side. It was textbook subdivide, you know, the stuff that we look for. And I lived there for a couple of years, and right in the middle of the road, there was like a little pocket that we went around. Didn't understand what was going on, and I remember the neighbor told us, like, you know, there's a cemetery right there, right? I was like, no way. And I already lived there for over 2 years, and I've been driving by this property twice a day. Cemetery right in the middle strip, and there was the historic landowners of that property that they buried them there, and they couldn't move the bodies or remove the gravesite, so they just built the road around it.
Right.
And we drove by it every day for years, and those were the historical landowners of that property from years ago. And I remember looking up the previous landowners after I got into land. I was curious about it, and they're the previous landowners that were literally buried right there. You couldn't tell the names on the gravestones because it was probably over 100 years old. And the last living descendant passed it on and sold it, and somebody subdivided it and built around it.
Whoa. All right, I got to ask this.
Yeah.
Being that we are in real estate, land, everything.
Yeah.
Have you had any weird supernatural incidences happen?
Just that one time that dog covered its face. No, I have never seen nothing, man. I've been to some weird properties. One, we got there. And it was like all overgrown. And then there's like this shed, like a weird looking shed behind the house, a big one, like made out of stone or something. And the door said, if I catch you in here, I'll shoot you. Ooh. So we're like, well, turn on the camera. We go in there, start getting video in there and everything. It was kind of creepy. But other than that, like, I've never seen nothing.
No.
Nah. You? What you got?
No, I got.
It sounds like you've seen something.
Yeah, I got.
You're forgetting the one property. So we did a deal back last year in June. We filmed on it. There was a 1900s hoe leaned up against the tree, left there.
That's an old lady.
The tree grew. We're talking about farming equipment.
It looked like an iron barrel of some sort.
Yeah.
Some kind of cart.
It was some type of cart, like hoe to till the ground. And it was leaned up against the tree. It was you could tell it was old equipment, but the tree had grown around it. And
it was so awesome, dude. It was the coolest thing you ever
really?
Seen.
Really?
The tree had grown around it, and it was just leaned up against the tree, and it was just there. And I'm like, this is...
It was now part of the tree. There's no way to remove it anymore. It was so badass. Yeah.
It was literally part of the tree now. And it was one of those things, like, one day the farmer stopped farming and just leaned up against the tree and never touched it again. And 100 years passed, and now the tree's around the whole farm.
It looks cool, dude.
Wow.
So I'll have to find that picture and put it into this.
I was telling Daniel, I was like, you know what? I would rather own that tree with that thing stuck in it than, like, one of these buildings.
Wow.
I'd rather have that tree on my property. You know, it's an amazing piece of history.
And it's one of those things where, like, if you pay attention and drive around these properties, there's a guy on Twitter, he owns a mountain in Tennessee, and he'll find, like, Civil War bunkers, and he'll find, like, Civil War encampments in the middle of the mountains, because that's where they were hiding in the Civil War. So he now owns this land, and he just explores. Literally explores in the land, finding random, like, muskets and stuff from that time period, and caves, and little hideouts from that time period. And I think it's such a cool aspect that we get to see on our side that a lot of people don't ever get to see. Like, you buy a 100-year-old home, you have to deal with city regulations about not cutting it down, not tearing it down, and rebuilding something new. And, like, with us, we kind of get, like, the before it was touched type factor. And you really get to experience a lot of, like, cool stuff that a lot of people will never even know about, because nobody talks about the stuff but us, because we're the ones who see it firsthand whenever we get the opportunity to go drive some ranches and stuff like that.
That's crazy.
I think that's part of something that I'm really, really enjoying about this business too. Yeah, just going to the different properties and seeing what's there. This last 240 acres we picked up has these massive oak trees, dude. And I'm walking that ranch with my family, and I'm looking at these trees, and it looks like something that they would put on a movie, like if it was like a fairy tale movie.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's like in some enchanted forest.
Yeah.
Just these big, amazing oak trees with spiraling branches. I was like, wow, that thing has to be 1,000 years old. You know, so it's cool to just have, like, a bunch of those on the property. Like, man, this is an amazing piece of art here.
Yeah.
So, like, anybody would be proud to build a house there or have some acreage there or something. Man, this is just a cool business because you get to see some nice things. I'd seen a property. It was in Jacksonville over by Tyler. It was, like, 120 acres. And I forgot what they wanted, like, 150 or something. And I'm like, man, 150 doesn't sound right. It's out in the middle of nowhere. I got there, bro. Beautiful red dirt. These freaking amazing trees on property. Like, tons of them. Like, I was like, who in the heck would sell this for $150,000? Yeah. Just when I got there, I was like, man, this thing is beautiful. So it's just cool to go out there and see the properties.
I think the biggest thing about that, too, is, like, all these properties have been passed down for years. There's a history behind that that's long gone.
Right.
But you can still find remnants of it somewhere on the property.
I love that part of it. Especially, like old farmhouses or ranches where you have out in a bunker or whatever they have... either a shed, like a big shed or something where they put their tractors in there. And, you know, when they're been abandoned for decades and decades and decades, sometimes over 100 years, you go in there, you open it up, and everything's just caked full of dust. But you see, I guess, the hole that you were talking about, the shovel. And you see all kinds of other stuff that was there, you know, maybe even tractor machinery or whatever may be the case.
Have you gone into the shop over there from the one we bought?
I took a video of it. It's so cool. Like, everything's just so, like, as it was. Yeah, and I love that, man. It's just like...
I'm afraid to just move anything because it just looks so cool.
I know.
Like, dang, once I clean it up, it's going to look a little different, but at least it'll still have the feeling. But right now, it's like, it's a snapshot in time.
Yeah, a snapshot in time.
It's pretty cool.
My grandpa had the same thing. I think I told you guys. So my grandpa had like 1,200 acres in Mexico on the border. And, you know, we all used to, you know, go out there for Easter and, you know, all the other holidays and go hang out. And I used to just get lost. And I love to get lost, man. That's the first thing that would happen to me. They would just open up the truck door and I'd just leave. I just kept walking because what it was is the topography and the way that the land was laid out was very fairy tale like, very sort of like a bookstore. You go in and I felt like I was like the Hobbit, like just literally going through different pathways. And the pathways were all created by coyotes and goats and cows and everything in between. So you got these little pathways that are going right, you know, underneath trees and bushes and all kinds of stuff. So to me, it's like, where's Waldo? Like, I'm just getting lost into this. Where is it leading? Yeah. And every time I'd go, I'd get lost for like literally 30 minutes or an hour and everybody'd be freaking out. But I would know where to turn around. And every time I'd get lost, I would always find myself to see the skeleton remains of animals. And they would be kind of half buried in the ground. And I would be thinking to myself, like a, almost like a paleontologist, like from Jurassic Park. I'm like looking at the bones as a kid. I'm like, what is this? Cow head, horns, and all this. So I was like infatuated with like the whole farm and ranch lifestyle as a kid. And I did that for years. It was like one of my best times of my life.
Not coming full circle.
Yeah.
Dude, I've never spent any time on a ranch, so I didn't have similar experiences growing up. It's like our family didn't have it. Their family didn't have it. None of our friends had it. Everybody we knew was poor. We didn't have no land. Not even to somebody like, oh, my friends, we go hunting. Like, we never been hunting. You can't hunt when you live in an apartment, right?
Yeah.
But their dads know somebody that has a ranch and all that. And we never did, so I never really cared to have one. Yeah. And especially I wasn't going to spend money to go have the ranch life.
Right.
Right? Because, like, no, man, like, I got other things going. I'm not that into it. But now that we're getting them and they're paying us to pick them up, like, dang, now we're getting used to it. We already barbecued out there a bunch of times. We're out there putting up target, shooting, clearing trees. You know, we're just, like I said, just now we're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Four-wheeler, freaking everything. Like, everything. Oh, damn, okay, this is actually kind of fun. So people are like, hey, out the ranch. People are just showing up. We're just cooking out. Like, oh, dang, all right.
It's fun stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. And so I wasn't interested in it enough to spend money on it.
Yeah.
But now that it's paying us, like if you're gonna pay me to make me have this experience, right. That was a good feeling, man. It dawned on me like I was just having such a good time. The kids are on the freaking 4x4 thing, and I'm just like, wow, oh damn, they paid me to do this. And people pay really, really good money to have the same experience.
Right.
So I feel blessed just to be in this business. Like, whoa, like this is tremendous. This is like life changing, like life altering. To see my little great niece just running back and forth, just having fun, screaming at the top of her lungs, and she was like, I want to go back to your house at the ranch.
It's a different lifestyle.
Like, dang, we've never had this experience before, man. It's a blessing.
Yeah. So all we need to do is just buck some goats, man. We're good to go. You ever done that?
Mm-mm.
You get on a little goat and just try to saddle us. So apparently, Drake.
Hey, guys. We're talking about raising capital today. Raising capital is we didn't know how important it was early on. But now knowing what we know, 5 and some change years later, it's become the most important thing that we focus on. I think if you make raising capital the primary part of your business and nothing else, everything else falls into place. But we're going to talk today about the caveats and some things that would make it challenging to raise a lot of capital, maybe even unethical to raise a significant amount of capital in some cases. So we're going to do a deep dive on that today. Should be a fun conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first of all, you got to have, in order to raise capital, where do you get it first? Family and friends, right? We just want to get family and friends because they know, like, and trust you. I think is the first caveat.
That's a good point, actually. I never actually just thought about it that way. Yeah, the people that already know you and trust you are cool putting some cash into your business because they know where you're headed.
Absolutely. So I think that's the first place to get it. Number two is that you got to have a track record. I think a lot of family, your mother is the one who's going to believe it. The only person that's going to believe in you the rest of your life.
Your mom's more forgivable, probably.
Your mom's more forgivable. If you lose $50,000 on a deal, your mom will be like, oh, it's okay, mijo. It's okay.
Right.
But so it's kind of a lot harder to do that with anybody else. And not that we lose money, but I think if you're just starting out, you could lose money. I think
Surveys, engineering, there's a lot of upfront costs, earnest money. You can lose money pretty quick in this business.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think you have to get it from people you know, like, and trust, people who are friends and family. But I think once you get out of that, you have to get to a point where you're doing good business. And I think it takes a deal of going through a deal like you did, going through those hard issues and trying to figure it out by yourself. And I think we did that for a couple of years where we tried to position our lenders into a good position because we wanted a long-term relationship where now we can have a new lender come in and like, hey, talk to our old lender. They've been working with us for 2 years now.
Yeah, we just got one of those follow-ups. So somebody gave us a referral. She did a deal with us. And then that person gave us a referral with somebody else. And now he's ready for his next deal. So I think having a high volume of deals is important, right? Having integrity, making sure that you get your investors back their money.
Absolutely.
In a timely manner and with some upside, hopefully, right?
Yes.
They say there's not in real estate, like I said, don't concentrate on your ROI. Concentrate on the return of the investment.
Yeah.
Like at least if you don't lose your money, you did pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So I think having integrity, doing good deals, making your investors tons of money, of course, speed and transparency. Keep it in contact with your investors, letting them know how the deal's going and if there's hangups, why. kind of some of that stuff, especially if it's their first time working with you, because they're like, I don't know if this guy's a scam or what.
Yeah. If he sees you in a Lambo, he's looking at you sideways.
Wait a minute. I just invested $1.2 million with you guys, and you pull up in a new Porsche. Like, I don't like this one bit. What happened to the big truck with the big tires?
So one thing I really want to tell you is that these relationships are priceless, priceless. So a lot of people in the investment space, they go through a hard money lender, and they got a 10 document with a $2,500 fee to even have them look at your documents,
right,
and all this stuff with a hard money lender. But when you get a good private money lender, you do good business with, what do you get?
They wire you the funds without even being on title.
it's literally a no doc lender. I've never heard of that before.
Send the funds, or you just call me when it closes. Have a nice day.
A no doc lender.
They're not on title. There's no lien. There's no deed of trust. No nothing. Like, all right, thank you.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah,
that's insane.
Even like, Jesse's the first time he heard that one.
He's like, what?
Insane. Wow.
Pretty cool, man. And it seems like this is another little tip and trick right here. If there was a little hack for raising capital. The more money that the investor has, and the bigger you ask them for, it's a lot easier. Yeah. So like if you say, hey, can I get 5 M's or 2 M's? It's like, what do you got? You got to do it. But if you ask somebody like, hey, can I get 10 grand? Like, oh, dude, I'm out, man. I got to talk to my wife. I mean, I got to talk to 2 bankers and the guy from FedEx.
CPA. Yeah. 2 chickens at home.
I got to write the letter to the IRS. They got 6 weeks to respond. You know, for 10 grand, like, dude, let's just, oh, you keep the 10,000. Don't help me.
Yeah.
But when it's an M, somebody's like, let's do it. Like, oh dang, okay, so they're quicker to make decisions, they're more trusting, right? Yep. They're smarter because they're gonna analyze your deal harder.
Yep.
Right.
But once they see that it's a good solid deal, then the money comes quick.
So oh, yeah. we had a lunch with one of our mentors yesterday, and he was telling me how he had a 10-minute conversation to raise $4 million, and he's like, yeah, I'm in for $4 million, let me know the wire instructions. It hangs up. Like,
the easiest raise of your life. Like I said, and you try to raise 50 grand from an investor, and it's like, man, if you lose this 50 grand, I'm going to be bankrupt. You know, so it's like, I don't want that guy's 50 grand. Yeah. Right? Not that we're going to lose it, but like,
they're holding tight to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Afraid to even drop it. So like, dude, that's not the money. For the rule of thumb for investments is don't invest what you can't lose.
Yep.
Right? So I would say treat it almost like gambling. If you can wager 50,000, and if you lose it and nothing happens to you, then that's when it's time to invest, and you'll be okay. But you don't want to like put your last $10,000 into a deal because you never know what's going to happen. So in that case, if that is your last dollar, you partner with a guy like Jesse who has money, Daniel, somebody that can get the resources and help you close the deal. And that's the way to do it instead of risking your own capital at that stage. So, but once you move above there.
One thing I'll say to this too is that vet your lenders.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Vet your lenders.
Don't be afraid to dismiss a lender.
Yep. So some lenders, and this is from experience, They'll come in and try and strong arm you, or they don't understand the essence of the transaction, so they'll do 90 days of due diligence and never close.
Yeah, we're pretty quick to turn down funding when the person doesn't understand our business model. They have to have a really good understanding of what we do and exactly how we do it, where the money comes from, how we make profit, right, when we make profit. And the more that the lender understands the deal, then the easier it is for them to put that money up.
Yeah, because we have instances where we had a lender come in, and this is all time-wise. We get locked the deal up for 90 days, and you have due diligence time, but you're also working up that lender. Like, there's all these different types, all these different sides of the transaction. You got to deal with the seller, you got to deal with the lender. And this is one of the things that even our team doesn't really understand, is because we handle the lender side of it, is we have capital to deploy, but it's our lender's capital. We have that relationship to deploy at the right opportunity, but we need the timeline to make sure that solidify the deal is a good deal for them, to make sure they're comfortable putting it up, because it's not our money. We have to make sure the lender is up to par and up to standard of all the information that needs to make sure they understand it's a good opportunity. So a lot of underwriters, they'll take their time, like, oh, I'll look at it, or I need to come see it personally, and then they drag out, and then you have, hey, we need another $5,000 to extend. And you're like, is he going to close?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So you got to vet your lenders out early and make sure they understand the timelines going into it, because we've had deals like, hey, we need to close next Friday. Oh, yeah, we're good. And then the day before, they're like...
Just had one.
They ghost.
Yeah.
They go ghost.
Yep.
And it's that blows up the whole deal.
No, well, we still bought it.
It can for most people.
Yeah. Like, we're going to perform no matter what. But yeah, but having multiple lenders on staff, on hand, having a lot of great relationships instead of just depending on one person.
Yep.
So in that reason, like I said, you know, it's kind of a last minute thing. Hey,
right.
We need 90 bands. It's on the way. So yeah, you want to make sure that you can perform on your contracts all the time. It's kind of part of the game is just having extra lenders in your back pocket.
How do you feel about ROI that you give to lenders?
Here's my philosophy, man. People like to you know, talk about, you know, real estate investors, high level real estate investors making 12 to 18%, beyond 18% usury, right? So there's a gray area there. But I think that if somebody's a strong enough lender, right, like if they can put in $1 million or $2 million or $5 million or $10 million, I'll split deals with them 50-50 all day. And people are like, what? Like, that's, y'all are paying too much for lenders. Well, like, you don't have the right to tell me that I'm paying too much for money because you're not lending it to me.
Yeah.
You say, if you said, hey, bro, don't pay that much, I got you.
Yeah.
Right? Then here's how much I want back. But yeah. So they're like, oh, y'all are paying too much. We're like, how much are you charging?
Yeah.
All right.
Right.
So you didn't lend it to me, so it's not really their concern. If we can pay back great returns to our lenders, you know, we make great returns.
Everybody has their opinion.
Yeah.
Everybody has their opinion based on their money.
Like, was that the end of your sentence? Like, y'all are overpaying for money. Like, go ahead.
are you going to pull out your wallet, sir?
Oh, yeah. I thought you were about to write me a check. Never mind.
Oh, man.
That's perspective. It's perspective. And everybody has their opinion on it. And, like, me and Anthony always laugh because, oh, man, everybody wants 12% with 3 points underwriting. And, you know, like, dude, that's cheap money, bro.
You're going to have it.
Yeah. So, like, the one thing, if you're a land investor looking at this, it's very, very, very hard to get financing, any type of investment on land. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people, the one number one rule is investing is invest in only things that you understand. Nobody understands land except people that operate in it. So, if you're trying to raise money for land investing, for your own business, whatever you're doing, you have to be transparent. You have to almost educate them on your process. We had meetings with our lenders. Like, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is what we've done in the past. This person lended on it. We gave them this ROI. It took this amount of time. And this is what we did with it. Here's the before and after pictures, you know. Like, you really have to, like, educate front-end-wise on every transaction, every lender. Because these lenders don't know anything about land at all. We're starting from scratch. It's a brand-new newbie. All they have is money, and you gotta educate them. How do you find the deal? Well, we find on MLS, we negotiate great terms. How do you get great terms? Well, you wait 6 months and you ask.
Hey, ask a bunch of times.
You ask a bunch of times and wait 6 months.
Ask a bunch of different people. I think what's cool is that the size of the returns we're getting, right? We got lucky to be in the land business, right? You know, it's God's favor. And the returns are tremendous. So. It's cool that we accidentally kind of stumbled into such an amazing space. Like, we didn't sit down and run scientific models, you know, about this market and the Texas market and what the potential profit per year is. We just got lucky. We got into the business and, like, whoa, dang. And so now when other investors from other asset classes see the returns that we can provide, they're like,
uh-oh,
this looks good. Like, are you sure? We've heard too good to be true a bunch of times.
Right.
Like, wait a minute. Are you sure? Like, dude, this
too good to be true. It's not true at all.
Yeah. Here's everything. And, like, furthermore, put the property in your own name and just pay us when it sells. And
yeah.
Like, really? First position? Like, yeah. We believe in it. If you don't make no money, you don't pay us nothing. You know?
That's true.
So, and the lenders out there are like, well, I can figure this out. We've heard people losing their ass because they don't have the expert investor to guide them, and they'll overpay for properties. We had an opportunity. We had an instance come up recently where
we had to bail some people out.
We're trying to. I don't know if we can. I don't know if we can. They got it too high. So this pool of investors, it's like 10 to 15 investors. They pulled together and bought like 250 acres for $3.5 million.
That's how much they got in?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's a tremendous mistake.
Yeah. They're at like 12,000 an acre per across all the properties. And they're at a year holding it. They cannot sell it. They bought, the frontage isn't as nice as we'd like it to be to cut it up to do things. So now it needs a road and more money to develop. And there's just in a partially sinking ship. And I really want to help them, but they're kind of stuck because they bought wrong. They bought too high. They bought the wrong property.
You got to know how to buy, where to buy. You got to know what's around you, resources, potential, rooftops, populations, mm-hmm. you know, distance to import, like grocers and all that kind of stuff. So knowing your product better than everybody else, that's very, yeah. very helpful. And being able to convey that information over to your lender and so, make sure you know, you sound like you know what you're talking about.
This is the other thing. So one of our lenders asked us, because most of the lenders, they want, most underwriting, they're like, oh, if I'm going to put money down, put money in, what you got to put money down to cover, secure the risk up. And most of the deals we do, we don't put any money down.
We're zero in, or we don't do the deal. And for the most part, any lender that wants some kind of like, hey, well, you guys put 10, and I was like, well, then you find one deal and I'll find one, and we'll work together. But if we have the deal, we're in control of how that deal needs to flow.
And the reason why is because, and we had a lender ask us this question. He's like, well, what are you putting into the deal? And we had the point blank sale, like, hey, we got a good opportunity. We got seller financing. We got 0% interest.
$400,000 off.
$400,000 off. And we're going to get you a great ROI. And he was like, okay.
Yeah.
And that was enough to get that conversation going. Because if you're doing a house, what is their security? I mean, most of the time you have a $30,000 to $50,000 spread. Things can go wrong. Timelines can go wrong.
Yeah. And then now you turn your private investor into a remodeler, a contractor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You bail on the deal. Now like, well, now I've got to take over this nightmare. But with land, they just get to just ride on, put up some fences, survey it off, hire an agent, it's done.
It's done.
Absolutely. So, and this is one of the things we're like, our biggest thing is that we're finding great opportunities. Great opportunities, 50 cents on the dollar or less.
30 cents, 25 cents on the dollar.
Under 50 cents on the dollar. So, like, that's our biggest thing. Like, we're bringing a great opportunity with a very, and we were talking about this, unknown upside.
Yeah.
We're at least minimum 50 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
And we can add more things to make it more valuable, but it's up to our discretion to, if we want to go that far, if
right.
we need to. But one thing about land is that you can underwrite it as much, we talked about this earlier, you yeah. can underwrite it as much as you can. There's still going to be a wave of 25%, 20% of it can go
variance.
Up or it can go down.
Right.
Which is why we buy so cheap at 50 cents on the dollar, because if it varies 25%, are you ready to get a haircut? Which is, that's where that other buyer is at. They bought it like that 70%.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they're at that 20% dip, and now they're breaking even or losing.
Whoa, I didn't know that's what they did. Yeah, you got to be careful, because same way with houses where you got to be like 70 cents all in.
Right.
Similarly, land, it would be 70 cents all in after everything, after development, roads, surveys, engineering, flood studies, bringing in dirt. You know, we brought in like 20 truckloads of dirt on that one that we picked up, like yeah. 3 acres.
Yep.
And, you know, just to take the trash off the property is like $15,000.
Wow.
So yeah, these are pretty big undertakings. And if you don't know what you're getting into, yeah, then you can be in big trouble. So if you buy deep, keep looking. Right? There's a lot of good opportunities out there, but, you know, I think
with all these things that investors do, I always make sure to have two other people on standby. Besides everything else that you guys mentioned, is a good escrow officer.
Okay, absolutely.
Right? That and a really good real estate attorney.
Absolutely.
You make sure that.
Do you have somebody you like?
I have a couple of people, yeah.
I need a referral today, actually.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, your legal team is crazy.
Yeah.
I think it's the most important part of your business.
Those 1 month, we spent like $20,000 on attorneys. At once, and we're like, hey, most people don't even make this in a month, and we're writing a check to three different attorneys.
Oh my god.
Yeah, you gotta
I gotta tell this story. That
let's do it.
I gotta tell this story. So Anthony, I don't know if you remember this, but the way I met you was a while back, several months ago, I had this deal that I was trying to unload, and it was in Red Rock, Texas. And it was a 9-acre piece of property. So I had it under contract. We were trying to unload it. And I remember Anthony pinged me and said, hey, what's going on with this? So we had a conversation back and forth. And from there, we kept talking on some other stuff. But that deal, and this is why I said, you better make sure that you have a good escrow officer. So that deal turned out that I was dealing where I thought I was dealing with a seller, I was actually dealing with somebody that was a squatter.
Dang.
And the squatter somehow legally got the deed. There was a quick claim deed that was forged by the squatter.
Wow.
I don't know how he did it. But it passed. It passed through title and it did all that. And then my escrow officer, she's like, you know what? Something's not right here. And I didn't catch it because everything lined up correctly. We were looking at the lineage as far as, you know, who the owners were. The chain of title, everything. And nothing threw a red flag. And she's like, I don't like this. Give me a day or two. I need to get somebody else involved. So she got two other attorneys involved, plus her, to look at this. And she's like, she called me up again. She's like, hey, this person that you're dealing with, the owner, the actual owner's son, I just called him, and he doesn't know the seller, which is a squatter. And I'm like, really? It's like, yeah. Give him a call. So I called the original owner's son, which should have been... Yes. I called him up. I said, I think his name is David. I said, hey, David, my name is Jesse. I'm actually in contract with this property. Well, awesome. But you're not in contract. Your contract is not with me. I should be the one in contract with you. And I'm like, whoa. Oh, okay. So who am I in contract with? It's like, I don't know. I don't know that person.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, are you serious? And it was a $150,000 deal or something like that that we're going to possibly close on. And if that would have transpired, this would have been a nightmare.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, my God. I'm glad she's a badass. So, Marshall, if you're seeing this.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, man, great story. And I've had fraud happen to me one time. So having a... Oh.
Just keep turning that way and your neck is pressing into the microphone. So I'm going to adjust the shit real quick.
As you were.
Got him.
So thank you to... What was her name?
Marshall
for saving.
Independence
this,
title.
This is where like your title team comes in. We just did a video with our title company yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Go check that video out. It's gonna be on the podcast too.
Yeah.
But I think your that protection side of your team is a part of your team. Treat them like your team. They're a part of your team. We try and take care of our title company in a lot of different ways because
I'll just randomly call them up and say, like, "Can I send y'all lunch?" Chick-fil-A.
They will save your butt.
Oh, yeah.
They will save your butt. And this is like, I'm not a professional title. You're not a professional title.
No.
He's definitely not a professional title person. Those people are professional title person. They're going to save your butt a lot of times. So make sure you got good people on your team working those titles.
Yeah, so I think if you're looking to invest into these types of deals, having the right team in place is probably the single most important part of all of this.
Yep.
Because, like I said, you can have what you think is the best piece of property. You have all the funds ready to go.
At the right price.
But there's a lot of other moving parts, and there's a lot of experts working in concert to get these things done. So no one person, like not even myself, has all of the information. So we consult with other experts. We spent a couple hours at an engineering firm the other day going over a bunch of deals, right? So we're not going to become professional engineers. We're not going to become surveyors.
Right.
We rely on the people around us and the teams to be able to help us make these deals happen. So when you're looking to invest, you're looking to work with a team that actually knows what they're doing. I think we're doing a pretty good job. The returns that we are paying out are pretty amazing. So we're looking to put a fund together. So we got that going.
506C.
Mm-hmm.
Credit investors.
It's time.
Credit investors.
Yeah, so credited only for now. We are looking at doing some sort of crowdfunding in the future. But for now, yeah, we're looking for placements of $1 million and up to no more than about 25. So.
We're looking to raise $100 million.
Yeah, but you know they can only take 25. That's a max one person can take.
Why? There you go.
What he said.
It's going to be fun. And I think we have a lot of opportunity, and I think we can exhaust the capital. So a lot of people that invest in funds, they might not have the opportunity to find a right deal to exhaust it. I think we have a blue ocean strategy and we have a team available to deploy it. So yep. I'm excited about that.
I am too, man. We forgot to talk about one thing is how it could be unethical to raise capital and when. So when you're out there raising capital, you're telling these investors that you have these deals, these potential deals, investments.
Right.
They're going to give you the capital, and now it's your job to go and do that deal, see it all the way through, and then pay your investors back their money.
Right.
Right. So let's say you had a pipeline of $10 million. And that's all you had, $10 million worth of ranches. That sounds like you should probably raise $10 million or so, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe 12 or 15 to shore up some risk if you're going to do some development. But what you don't want to do is have $10 million worth of deals and go out and raise $100 million worth of capital, right? Because now you can get yourself into trouble if you end up having all that capital on hand. You already have to pay for it, right?
Or you never capital call it.
Yeah, so now you're going out wasting that time, wasting people's time because maybe they had $5 million that was going to go into another asset. You said, hey, no, don't worry. I got projects coming up. Go ahead and sign here. They're good for the $5 million. And then now you didn't perform because now that deal you said you had is not ready to go. Dude missed the boat on something else he wanted to get into. So I think having a long pipeline like we do, I would say we're well over 100 million now, easy. It's growing faster by the day. So if we go out and raise $100 million, like I said, we can probably place it on, 3 to 6 months.
Absolutely.
So having a long pipeline and lots of deals in the pipeline, that's, I think, the only ethical way to go out and justify raising those types of numbers, like 100 million or 500 million, if you have that many deals ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Very true. Take care of your lenders.
Absolutely.
Cool, man. Well, I hope you guys stay safe out there. Have fun. If you see anything that we are working on that you would like to put some cash into, if you are accredited for now only, hit us up. That's what we can do.
HiveMindFund.com.
Thanks, guys. See y'all soon.